The following podcast contains scenes of abuse, graphic violence, elementals, extensive research, history, and all the good things that you can ever imagine. Listener's discretion is advised. Hi, how are you? Oh my god, yeah, I'm recording this episode, finally, I don't know, 3 hours before I'm supposed to launch it, and I'm shitting my pants right now, so let's get started. Welcome to the 17th episode of In the Memory of the Goldfish, hosted by the most amazing 11-souled. Apparently, I do not have 12 souls anymore, and that was a miscalculation. I'm still at 11. 12, soon we'll have that. And 12th, what episode is this? This is the 17th episode, and in this episode, I am stoked. I am going to talk about the castle leap or lip from, like, some people were like lip, and the people who were pronouncing it as lip, the comments were like, it's not lip, it's leap. So I'm gonna go with leap because it is spelled castle, L-E-A-P, so like leap castle, and even Google seconds that, so I'm gonna go with that. Now, so about the episode today, it's ultra duper special because I hadn't been feeling well. I got diagnosed with the pandemic, yay. And not yet, yeah, whatever. So I was in no state to do the research or anything for the episode. So a very good friend of mine, Mr. Jordan, his Instagram handle is Selene Oracle. I will give him credits again in the end. He did the research for this. He even took the liberty to write down the skeleton for the story, which I worked upon and made it more a choristic story. And he did an amazing research. He read 3 books, knows more about the Irish Revolution and everything more than everybody else does. He's a super smart person. And it's because of him this episode is coming out as it is. So go follow him, love him, whatever. Follow him more than you follow me, because I am absolutely in love with the way he researched. Talking about the things that I'm absolutely in love with, today's fishy news has amazing things. So the first fishy news is, and I quote, William Amos, Canadian politician seen naked on Zoom work call. I mean, isn't that what we are always looking forward to when we join like a work meeting, you know? We want to look at a good old dong donging around. So he says, my video was accidentally turned on as I was changing into my work clothes after going for a jog, he said. The article further says that a screenshot of the incident was posted on social media showing Mr. Amos holding a mobile phone over his private parts. I mean, isn't that too convenient? I mean, we are sure Mr. William Annis, I mean, William Amos, didn't want to show his hot bod to like a hot colleague or something now. Like, yeah, that's like totally that, whatever this is. My brain is not functioning all right today, so just like calm down, calm everybody's tits. Listen to this. I'll try to speak less fast. I just realized I was speaking too fast. So, also, I had another question with the entire thing. Like, it's actually pretty funny, and the screenshot is most probably taken by somebody using their phone on the Zoom call, and I was like, yeah, why are you doing that? You know, the person is not really doing a cam show. So, like, the circulation of this picture, would that be considered as porn? Because basically, the guy is naked. And it's also not consensual. I highly doubt Mr. William asked the news channels to, like, you know, circulate his naked picture, though it was kind of censored by his own phone. And, like, and since they are doing that, wouldn't this be, like, character suit or something? I mean, yeah. So, there are a lot of problems here. He can make a lot of money suing all the media outlets, I think. Though later in the article, it said that when the meeting ended and everything, one of the seniors in the meeting said that necessary to remind all the members, especially the male ones, that a tie and a jacket are obligatory. I mean, yeah, Karen, like, just ask them to wear any clothing for fuck's sake. And like, you know, this thing I've done, I was attending a model union. Yes, I am that nerdy. And I wore like shorts, basically boxers. And I tucked my shirt and, you know, like I just dressed up totally nice and cute up and below. I was like wearing the shorts. And it was kind of stupid because I did end up wearing shoes because it was cold. But yeah, it gives you good gratification that you're almost naked during a work meeting of sorts. The second news is two women tried to spend 1 million bill at Dollar General store. I mean, okay, like, girls, if you're gonna fake something, at least do a good job at it. One should not learn from Kardashians how to fake things, you know, like fake things which are extra big, like a $1 million bill. And so, you know, these girls, they are like those children who hide behind the pole during hide and seek. And they think if they can't see you, you can see them. But no, that's not how it works. The article further says that Amanda McCormick, who said one of the, I don't know, culprits, criminals, I don't know. Like, she was not arrested. So, like, one of the people who she said that she received $1 million from mail. In the mail from a church, according to an incident report obtained by the smoking gun. Now, I did not look at the incident report. I did not look at what the smoking gun is. Just a news article using a source like the smoking gun was something so ridiculous in its own that I was like, yeah, we're gonna have that. And you know that televangelist Kenneth Copeland who blew Corona away. If people like that work in the church and the church sends you like a proper $1, I'm pretty sure it can be a counterfeit. Though, Amanda, claimed that she was using the money to buy care packages for people who were experiencing homelessness. So she's kind of cute and not that bad. She just didn't know that Jesus had now entered the business of making super fake counterfeit cash, among other things. Desperate times calls for desperate measures. Coronavirus made the heavens go broke. And moreover, I researched more on this because this was actually pretty interesting. So in the United States, the largest bill ever printed for public circulation was a $10,000 note, according to the Federal Reserve. The bill was printed in 1945 and along with some other discontinued denominations of $500, $1,000 and $5,000. And it was issued until the 1969 fun year to discontinue a huge ass bill. And the largest bill that I could find in like the entire world was 500000000 and 12 other zeros. Dinar. I do not know how much money that would be, which was from Yugoslavia. Yugoslavia's hyperinflation in 1993 to 1994, when the currency basically doubled every day and a single US dollar equaled like about 6 trillion Yugoslavian dinars. Now one can find like bills which are like 500 million dollar dinar notes, which sell for 1.79 US dollars. But let me count the zeros and get back to you. Just one real second, soon, fast, whatever. My brain is not functioning. The amount in English was 500 quintrillion dinars. That is three steps ahead of trillion. So, yeah, it's time for an ad break. I hope you enjoyed that. Anyway, talking about the things which are in million in today's out of the blue, it's sticky, it's smelly, it's gel-like. And yes, today we talk about semen. Finally, men and their private parts get some proper coverage on this podcast. Basically, I went on to read the Encyclopedia of African Religions. So I ended up, and not only that, and other things during my free time as somebody who was locked down into my own room and couldn't really even meet my cat. You know, my cat is not allowed to meet me. Today he entered my room for the first time because everybody else in the house also kind of got the virus. So I'm no longer in quarantine. Like, I don't need to stick at my room. I can walk around the house now. That is what I mean. I'm no longer in quarantine. It does not mean I can walk. I'm walking out of my house, really. And also, I'm recording this episode in the middle of the day. So there's gonna be most probably a lot of disturbances today. And yeah. Anyway, so the next, I believe, 3 to 4 episodes are chiefly gonna, off Out of the Blue specifically, are chiefly gonna contain folklore, legends, gods and goddesses from all over the world. And like, I would raise the simple question, how people can be so comfortable in accepting such legends, you know, why don't you change them? The first one, I thought it would make a lot of sense if it's the most, if it's the, yes, that's how I speak now. It would make sense if the first one is the most gross one, and like my nose is blocked, and all I can think about a Korean noble basically barebacking my nostrils with two of his dicks. And yeah, so let's make other things amazing for you, you know. So basically, according to the Encyclopedia of the African Religions, in many African traditions, the sky is the god of sky and the husband to the earth. And basically, whenever the earth needs fertilization, it releases its sacred semen, rain, and semen also comes in another form by the sky, that is the sunlight which shines onto the earth, fertilizing it. Basically, the sky is a huge man with trillions of dicks which keep on shagging when it rains, and I am maybe the clouds are the pubic hair, I'm not sure. And like, it also said, like, this is something which I was not able to understand, that rain is the sacred semen and so is the light which nourishes her. So I do not understand how, like, are we basically the entirety of the atmosphere is a sex orgy between, you know, the earth and the sky? And technically, I just thought of this. Lightning bolts are basically the sky penetrating the earth, so it's like the sudden boner which is like, but suddenly thrust itself in and out. Yeah, I'm getting ahead of myself. So yeah, I mean, imagine asking the gods when like you're praying for rain to start having sex, and how awkward would that be for the gods? Like, imagine 500 people like have sex, have sex, have sex, and when you're finally having sex, they're like these little organisms which are not your own sperm, who are eating the sperm, who are dancing in it, and you're like, yeah, no. So yeah, but like this. Like, I feel it's because of dynamics like these all over the world that the gods feel like leaving humans alone. Though on the other side, this dynamic had even more fun, like good things about it, jokes apart. The farmers basically ask for permission before they sow anything in the earth. They ask for permission, they ask for forgiveness as they would be breaking the ground to plant their seeds, as the whole earth is a living organism, and any useless digging and shit was just basically condoned upon because you don't want to dig into things and, like, you know, cut people open like that. And even when it was done with a lot of care. Now, the women had the responsibility of placing the seed in the earth itself, which was an analogy between earth and their own creative power to create life and such. I also read in some of the cultures, women are given a demigod status when they're pregnant. Though I was like, yeah, everybody should be given a demigod status no matter what. Like, being pregnant does not, should not equate to you know, divinity, because that's not the only thing with women. And like, that was like, initially I read that, okay, why am I getting that care out? Then I realized, no, that's kind of derogatory for any woman who cannot bear children. She's basically a human and everybody else is gods. And yeah, no, everybody's a god, everybody's celestial. But yeah, at least that's what they think, that's what they believe in. All right. And so, though the dynamic in itself is actually nice and it's very respectful, now the concept of rain being sperm is a running concept, and it does not only limit itself to, you know, women and soil. Everything that creates something which is important is basically sex. Now, like, though through things like metalworking, it's considered that the work of blacksmiths is seen sacred. Now, the forge is usually considered as a spiritual sanctuary. When the day starts, they meditate and they offer sacrifices to the gods. In the forge, the primordial creative act is reenacted by the smith and the, like, you know, his tools. The heat, hearth, is considered as the female element, and the mass of the anvil is considered as the male organ. And you go like bang, bang, bang. And then no wonder when everything hits each other, sparks fly. Yes, that was such a good pun. And this that would be the end of today's Out of the Blue. I think it's a shorter one than usually. Next time, I'm not sure if I should tell you guys. Next time I'm going to talk about, no, I won't tell you, let that be a surprise. It's going to be about a goddess from Haiti, and like two of Haiti and Haiti? No, not Haiti, Hawaii. Two Hawaiian legends of their gods and goddesses. It's going to be a ride and it's going to be amazing. Talking about things which are amazing, let's come to the story of this episode. And the story, as you've read from the episode title, is called Clash of Clans. Yeah. The date given to the story is 25th November 1915. The time is 8:12 in the morning. The story begins with, I placed my index finger on the little hole in the wall in front of me. I took a breath in and gave it out. The out-breath colored gray, telling me that I live. Not for long, though, if I be as stuck as I am to my father's words. Never visit a lady without washing yourself. And no man washes with water that's warm. And so I went in. I placed my feet in the freezing waters. I grabbed the pitcher. I do not know what it was. Once my feet were down under, submerged in the water, colder than an English lady's stare, they started to warm up to the cold. The next shock, which took me a good hour to recover, came from the water, from the pitcher, once it touched my skin. Oh well, oh well. This was passing. A self-inflicted torture it was. Nothing more. I could feel the bone behind my ears becoming hard as steel, that it felt like it was not the part of my skin anymore. You know, this is a paragraph that I personally relate to so much. Like, I took cold water showers the entire year last year to like boost my immunity, and guess what it got me? But nothing other than this exact same experience. And I actually researched about the Irish bathrooms to write this story. So a pat on the back for me. And that's why even the episode art is that of a pitcher and a water basin. I continue with the story. I wrapped the terry around me. Terry here means cotton. Terry here means towel, I believe. My fingers started to look purple. My feet a gawking red. My body seemed to have been painted by a lunatic artist. Lunacy, which some will find bonny. Yes, my thoughts, they often rhyme. I wore my clothes, upon all, the grey turned brown coat of my grandfather. As I wore it, the instruction list from Anne fell down. The first point, don't embarrass me. She always brought a smile on my face. We have a crush. And the other points basically revolved around The sight of a soldier from the barracks bear slithering around the castle would not make Jonathan Derby the sixth, the great-great-grandson of Sir Admiral Henry Desdaire Derby. So we must remain in the lower wing of the castle, a priest house, where very priestly things happened. Like, that's the side note. And that I am required to tend to the circumstantial need. Upon reaching the leap, Anne took me through, took me in through the small passageway on the left. You know, this castle, like, one, when one imagines a castle, you imagine like a, you know, a Disney kind of thing. So, but this one, it is so freaking gothic. It is a lot in the vibes of that show, Disenchanted on Netflix. It's not like a castle you would imagine. The corridors are small, the doors are pretty small, everything's narrow. It's amazing. I wanna live there. Anyway, where am I? Upon reaching Leap, So she took him in the through the lift, small passage beyond the lift, while walking swiftly and rubbing her hands sort of like this, making this sound. I like this sound, kind of. I hate it, actually. She explained to me the circumstantial need that Master Derby would be arriving late. The circumstantial need also included the sightings of the elemental and the terror that it harbored among the staff of the Leap Castle. And majorly, Miss Mildred Derby, the wife of Master Derby, will, I heard that. And, what? And the wife of Master Derby, well, I heard that. I could look forward to the tour of the castle. I believe what I'm trying to say is that, Miss Mildred Derby was totally bonkers about the elemental. Yeah, that's what I wanted to write in that line. I have no idea what I wrote. And I could look forward for the tool of the castle. All elementals might as well bow down to me, for I did take a bath. Yes, bath makes you an invincible human being. The next timestamp is 1924. Anne was still wrapping up the work. I, for the most part, simply looked at her work on the next to the next batch of the sourdough. I heard horses and wheels. The naval officer was earlier than I expected. You know, I wasn't sure in the 1912, would the naval officers be in like carriages or, you know, those cart thingies? Would they be walking? Would they be on horseback? Or would they be on in a car? So I was like, yeah, both. They used horses and wheels. If it was a carriage, perfect. If it was a car, perfect. If it was anything, both of these things were there, perfect. Back to the story. The naval officer was earlier than expected and asked me to stay where I was to be as quiet as a mouse. She came back, a little short of breath, saying that the mistress of the castle specifically asked us to remain in the lower wing much more now that the Mr. Derby is back. Also, the time changed the timestamp to 1824, not 1924. Though, obviously, she said rather slyly, we can sneak into the central hall of the castle, lofty one, obviously when the Derbys are off to change for dinner. Post this, we had a merry dinner in the confines of the priest house, soon after which Anne went in to check on the masters of the castle. Their coast was clear. On our way to the hall, we passed through the gallery. An eerie smell and what my brain could simply intercept as an ominous energy surrounded us. My eyes turned to Anne, maybe looking for an explanation. Her eyes were as bewildered as mine were. We looked at each other, not knowing what it could be. Though I knew that we both were hoping it to be, not to be, what we were hearing about by what we speculated as the rumors of the Lady of the Leap. I have written this story like so drunkenly, or I am drunken right now on medicines that I'm reading, and I'm like, what? And it's a fairly long one. It's 3 pages of what I'm talking about. So this is my part, like the part which this is like reconstruction of the Jordan part, and the next part which is to come will be my part. So basically, I was gonna give you like a summary of the story so far, but I'm gonna continue. My brain suddenly prompted me to stare into the corridor. The air was tense. You could cut it with a knife, I bet. As my eyes managed to focus, I saw it. A beast-like bear, rather a lion, maybe even a little bit of both, staring right back at us. It didn't move. We felt as if we couldn't move. As vanished my confidence in my guts, so did the being in front of us. It felt as if, for those seemingly infinite moments, my heart forgot to beat. My blood stopped flowing. All that existed in front of me was there, and it faded away and out, as if guarding the secrets of the leap, making sure we heed to the commands of the lady. To the hollow commands of the lady. It was after that it vanished. Time started to flow again. Anna. Oh my god, I've been reading the word Anna as Anne since forever. Now it's Anne. Anne and I did what we had always done best. Run away. We ran off to the priest's rooms. Priest's room. 26th December 1915. 10:33, that is the very next day, kind of early morning. About a minute back, Anne came rushing into the quarters to tell me that Miss Mildred had called upon us. It appeared to me that she was quite waiting frantically for Mr. Darby to leave. We entered the study. It had many books, a lot of sitting, and one off-putting black table near the window. It was evident that she wished to interrogate us about the task she assigned. We explained to her briefly what happened, with confidence that she'd understand, for it was her words that we were belittling as rumors. Upon hearing us, she stood up, walked to the gloomy table, and opened the blue box with golden borders. Within it seemed to be over a score of letters. Her hands had blisters. I do not know how a lady of her standing could even get them, you know. She handed to us the letter she had written to Sidney Carroll, which stated as below. The last appearance of the elemental were on 25th, 1915, and I deduct again. Last November from my gate of my husband, really wild with rage, fright. Coming into my room at midnight to let fly at me for dressing up things and try to frighten me. On 25th November 1915, two of her servants, knowing the master, would be back late that I was driving that afternoon, had invited friends, in quotations, over, two soldiers from barracks at Beer, distant the other side 6 miles. They came rather late and my husband was home early, so the visitors have to be kept out of his sight in the lower rings of one of the wings, priest house in parentheses, and were unable to be shown the center tower, a very lofty hall. Oh my god, you know, this letter in the context of the story basically is a letter that she wrote in the past, talking about the future to somebody, and like the letter was already exchanged, so she had gotten it back too. And I am coughing so much while recording the podcast. Every 2 minutes I'll like pause the thing and I do it again, so the editing is gonna be shitty too in this, and there's gonna be a lot of cuts. Yay. Okay. At 1915, my husband and I went to dress for dinner. My room in the extremity of the house from the kitchens, his dressing room was next to me. Whilst dressing, I was startled by a loud yell of terror-stricken male and female voices coming apparently from the hall, and ran out there to see the cause. My husband was ahead of me at his heels. I passed through the corridor of the wing onto the gallery wing, round two sides of the hall. Two lamps on the gallery, two more in the hall below. In the gallery, leaning with hands, in quotations, resting on its rail, I saw the thing, the elemental, and smelt it only to will. At the same moment, my husband pulled up sharply, about 10 feet from the thing, and half turning, let fly a volley of abuse at me, ending up dressing up like a thing and that tried to try and make a fool of me. And now you'll say I've seen something and I have not seen anything, and there's nothing to see or ever was. The last speech was without a pause. Began waving one hand at the thing up by stalking up to his dressing room, still abusing me for trying to give him a fright. As he was speaking, the elemental grew fainter and fainter in its outlines until it disappeared. By the sounds of my husband's room, I judged he was employed, as I was myself, in preparing an empty spot for our coming dinner. He never made an inquiry as to the yell that called both of us out. On the broader note to my past experience, I felt suddenly, you know, sorry, I'm not to cut the story in between, men are such idiots. Like, you freaking saw the woman in front of you. You saw the ghost in front of you, and then you still scream at her. Like, oh my god, you are the one who rest up, that was not me. Bloody idiot. I continue with the letter. On the broader note to my past experiences, I felt suddenly two hands were laid on my shoulders. I turned around sharply and saw, as clearly as I see you now, a grey thing standing a couple feet from me. With its bent arm raised as if it was cursing me, I cannot describe how utterly awful the thing was. It was very undefinableness, rendering that horrible shadow even more gruesome. Human in shape, a little shorter than I am, I could just make out the big shape of big black holes like great eyes and sharp features. But the whole figure, head, face, hands were all grey, unclean, bluish grey. Something of the colour and the appearance of common cotton wool. But oh, so sinister, repulsive, devilish. My friends who are clever about the occult would say it was an elemental. The thing was about the size of a sheep, thin, got shadow in parts. Its face was of a human, or to be more accurate, inhuman. In its vileness, with large holes of blackness for eyes, loose soberly lips, a thick saliva-dripping jaw soaping back suddenly into its neck. Nose it had none. Voldemort! Only spreading cancerous cavities. Yeah, it's Voldemort. The whole face began a uniform tint of grey. Voldemort. This too was the colour of the dark coarse hair covering its head, neck and body. Not Voldemort. Voldemort has a laser body, you know. Its forearms were thickly coated in the same hair, so were its paws, large loose hand shaped, and it sat on its hind legs. One hand or paw was raised, a claw-like finger was extended, ready to scratch the paint. Its lusterless eyes, which seemed half decomposed, looked incredibly foul, stared into mine, and the horrible smell which it had offered offended my nostrils, only 100 times intensified, came up to my face, filling me with deadly nausea. You know, if this person would have smelled better with less hair and such, this could have been a romantic story. I noticed the lower half of the creature was undefined and seemed semi-transparent at least. I could see the framework of the door that led to the gallery through its body. And yes, that's it. Tell me, what do you think of it? Regards, Mildred Darby. And so the letter ended. That was one fucking long letter. The last line of the story is, Miss Darby then glared at us for a while, as we try to make sense of how she wrote of the future that far in the past, and if she knew of the future, why invite us to know it better? And walked back into the dorm like the cold English lady she is. So yeah, that was the end of the story titled Clash of Clans. I'm pretty sure it was not what you expected it to be, and thank you for that. The story in itself, as I told you, the structure was given to me by somebody else. I just worked around it. The letter, which the entirety of the account of the, you know, the elemental and the servants and the two soldiers instead of one, and that bit is actually true. This is an actual letter which was written to Miss Darby, who's soon gonna come in the future, and we're gonna talk about Miss Darby. We're gonna talk about Sydney Carroll. Sydney Carroll was basically a distant relative of the original inhabitants of the castle. Basically, most of the story, instead of naming everybody koi and carp and fish and trout as I usually do, it was suggested that I should go with the actual name. So it's actually pretty darn real. And the letter verbatim is what she wrote according to the website that I found. So I basically started with the true crime incident within the story. I'm so smart. Yeah. So, though in the reality, as it states in the story, the servants did not like go back to the quarters. They screamed, they howled, they saw it, and the next day the entire staff signed for resignation. The servants, the soldiers who were there, they ran back off to the barracks. Huh. Now, this little paragraph, it's amazing. It's not written by me, and the entirety of the research is not written by me. It is compiled by Jordan, as I've told you before. And yeah, so I'm gonna read it as it is, and it's a very long research. I believe it is almost more than 8 pages. So sit down, have a tea. The research starts with a very interesting quote. The wise man avoids evil by anticipating it. A quote by Philippus Cyrus. Now, I can speak for the definition of the wise on the behalf of Cyrus. Neither I can anticipate a science party at the castle that holds the most unwanted accolade in the whole of Ireland. The castle that we talk about in this episode is Leap. Ireland's Leap Castle, located in Coolgerry, County of Offaly. So, basically first we are gonna go diving into the castle, of the history of the castle. The castle was built by the O'Bannon clan around 1250 AD, formerly known as the Liam Uy Bahanain, or the Leap of the Bannons. The O'Bannons were a secondary clan associated with the more powerful O'Carrolls, competitors for the position of the High King of Ireland until the earliest 12th century. Now, when the Kingdom of Munster was partitioned by the High King of Ireland, Torri del Buc or Concobahir, and effectively ceased to exist as a political entity. After their cessation of existences as political entities, the O'Bahirans thought to have lived in relative peace. The O'Carrolls, on the other hand, were a very fierce and brutal clan, as you will learn as we go on. Continuing to struggle for power and supremacy, they were known to be the particularly violent people. They were cunning in their attempts of domination. John O'Carroll was thought to be the first prince of Ely, who lived at Leap Castle. It's very probable that it was he who is responsible for the earliest construction of the sections of the castle, and John O'Carroll died at the Leap Castle during the plague of 1489. He was succeeded by Malorney O'Carroll, who ruled for 42 years until his death due to hemorrhage. That guy, he basically ran a fool of Gerald Fitz Fitzgerald, the 8th Earl of Glendale, and the uncrowned King of Ireland under the Tudors from 1477 onwards. A fairly interesting book titled The Annals of the Kingdom of Ireland, or otherwise known as The Annals of the Four Masters, basically a history of Ireland from the biblical flood until 1616, which was written by monks. So they decided, okay, everything's called annals. Reported that the Earl Fitzgerald attempted unsuccessfully to take over Leap in 1513 in a punitive campaign against the O'Carrolls. O'Carrolls were renowned for, like, the present O'Carroll, Milroney, was renowned for his strength, bravery, and valor, considered a great leader. The great he who most likely, again, So Milroney was succeeded by a son who was also by, who also went by the same name, and this is the son that we are talking about now. The son Milroney was renowned for his great strength and stuff. The great Milroney, as he was known later, died at Leap after a rulership of about 40 years. Milroney was then succeeded by his son Fearganhim. Fearganhim O'Carroll was rumored to have murdered a guest at the dinner table, his steward killing the servant in the guardroom. Fear himself was murdered in 1541 by the O'Malloys, and he was succeeded by his sons Tige, the one-eyed William, Malronid, and Waithne. I am butchering the name. Malronid and Waithne. And William, as I told you before. Tige, the one-eyed, was quick to assume command and was subsequently killed by his own kinsman, Cathair O'Carroll. Tige fathered a son, again named Milroney O'Carroll. Cathair was in turn slain by William Odar O'Connell, the younger brother of Tige, in 1554. William, the pale Odar O'Carroll, was murdered in 1581 by his O'Connor relatives. William fathered four sons, Tige, Milroney, John, and Charles. William was succeeded by his son, John, finally. So, from what you can see, it is a very old castle. It has a lot of deaths, and it has a lot of people killing other people, and a lot of people who killed other people getting killed by other people who were then killed by other people and their children who were killed by people. Yeah. And this is not even the half of the killings, you know. This is just the family tree. William the Pale, yes, I've talked about him. John O'Carroll was slain the following year by his cousin Milroney, who was the son of Tige, the one-eyed. This murder basically was avenged very swiftly by John's brother, Charles O'Carroll, by killing Milroney and becoming the Prince of Ely. He was given the knighthood in 1586. Now you're like, okay, knighthood, some kind of ethics, but no. Charles O'Carroll was then again slain after 14 years of being a knight in the 1600s. This was retaliation by Charles was previously killed 150 of his own men and some of the MacMahon nobles. It was thought that Charles had came to lose trust in some of his own men, and upon the time to pay them for their services, Charles had his few trusted men slay all of them while they were sleeping, because that's how you pay people back in Ireland. Now, the next what I'm going to talk about, is the Bloody Chapel. So by the 1557, the O'Carrolls were firmly in position again. They were busy bashing each other's head over the control of the clan, which is basically what they used to do back in the day. There was no said hierarchy, unlike the British monarchy. The High King basically means the king who was able to kill everybody or not die by the hands of everyone, depending on who the person was. Now, So everybody is busy killing everybody, and like including the Tegu Carol Fatality, who stabbed his own brother, a priest, during a mass at the Leap Castle's bloody chapel and saw him die at the altar. Basically, stay out of clans, do not talk to family. Family is kind of poisonous if you're in Ireland. Now, the account of Charles's death is absolutely spectacular. Charles, if Charles O'Carroll, the one that I'm talking about, is the dude who killed 150 of his own men due to his trust issues. First, the O'Carrolls were a Sith. The O'Carrolls were broken up, and I believe it may be because in Siths, unlike clans, legitimate and the illegitimate children, all up to three generations, can vote in the election. The Bloody Chapel was the opening round with the assassination of the brother and the priest by their own brother, Tege O'Carroll. Assassinations on the family sides continue, and the two sides became more and more violent. I can only guess it came down to a head and one side hired McConnells to assist. The McConnells were not known to be gentle. If you wanna, please Google Red Mary, who was basically a McConnell who murdered 25 husbands. So, fun people. So, basically these guys, one can say they were more charitable than O'Carrolls. The O'Carrolls knew of who they were working with, and I was told, what I was told is a mate overheard the McMarrons saying that once they dispatched half of the O'Carrolls, there was a dinner and then they will take in the castle because fuck O'Carrolls, no? Hearing this threat, Cathair O'Carroll dispatched his family rivals and dispatched the McMahons. Was this by poisoning them or cutting them all on the dinner table in the chapel or whatever? We do not know, but basically everybody was killed by the hands of Charles. The McMahon sought to support O'Neill, the High King of the time, and when the maid was asked to relate the story, she became unglued, and we'll never know if she was telling the truth. Regardless, Cathair now was in trouble. The castle was attacked, the O'Neills, the McMahons, the O'Carrolls, everybody's blood basically literally flooded the castle until nobody could really climb the spiral stairs. And I'm not over-exaggerating, this is actual folklore. A few leaders survived except Cahir's, Charles, and the Carrolls retained the castle because why not? And you know, we are still in the 1600s. We are now going to come to 1630, and the entire history that we were able to compile starts from the actual, like, start of the castle to the very present. Okay. Now, in 1692, John O'Carroll, nephew of Charles. What the fuck was that? Okay. Dogs are barking. Maybe it was some kind of fuck. In 1630, John O'Carroll, the nephew of Charles O'Carroll, was given the official ownership of the Leap Estate. In 1649, the property of Leap was handed over to the first of the Derby line, Jonathan. He was a soldier of the Cromwellian forces and was handed the property and the land in lieu of pay. I can get behind getting castles instead of pay, you know. In 1664, the property was handed back to John O'Carroll due to his continued loyalty to Charles I. This arrangement was unfortunately again reversed in 1667, in less than 3 years, due to differing views of Charles II. Leap Castle was back to the Derbys. Now, Jonathan, he had a son and a wife called Deborah. The son was again called Jonathan. Jonathan III was married in 1693 to Anna Maria d'Ester, and in 16, I just made that French, I'm not sure if she was French, And in 1698, Jonathan III, who was tried for treason, was sentenced to be hanged, drawn, and quartered. During the power shift within the British monarchy, Jonathan Darby was again pardoned by William of Orange, who was subsequently crowned the King of England. Jonathan III is thought to be the Wild Captain. I'm going to talk about the Wild Captain later on. He was so freaking cool. I'll talk about him right now. He was like, he ordered his servants to hide all his riches in the walls of the castle, and he was somehow able to do that, though he was decapitated, I believe, in Dublin later on after a little while. Now, Jonathan III had a son who was also called Jonathan IV, who was born in 1708. Jonathan IV married Suzanne Lovett in 1745 and died in 1776. Jonathan IV was succeeded by his sons, Jonathan V, who was born at Leap in 1756, and Henry d'Estaire, who was born in 1748, Robert and two others, who were Robert and Christopher, who were born in 1758. So basically, Jonathan V kept himself busy. Jonathan Darby V maintained the Leap estate until his death in 1802, as Jonathan did not harbour any male children. The Leap castle was handed over to his brother Henry. Henry d'Estaire Darby was born in 1748. He climbed through the naval ranks to become Sir Admiral Henry d'Estaire in 1799. Henry died in 1823, bearing no children of his own. And upon his death, the Leap Castle was again inherited by his brother John Darby. John Darby married Anne Vaughan and died in 1834. He was succeeded by his sons, William Henry Christopher George Susan Jonathan, Otario d'Estaire, John Nelson, and Sarah Derby. William Henry Derby inherited the castle in 1880. His eldest son died in 1872, aged 45, so the Leap Castle was then passed on to his grandson, Jonathan Charles Derby. Jonathan married Mildred Darby in 1889. Now we are at the same similar time zone as the story, finally, in the 1800s. So, like, a time period I can imagine. I cannot imagine the world before in the 1600s and the time before that. They're like, this happened. And like, yeah, no, it did not, because the world does not exist in the 1600s. But yeah. So from another source on Mildred Darby, and also the Wild Captain, the Jonathan III, it says, from 1659 to 1922, the Leap Castle passed into the hands of notable Darby family, which not only produced a number of British admirals over the years, but included one Mildred Darby, a Gothic writer known to hold seances in the castle. Now, I have nothing against Gothic writers and people who go ahead and do seances per se, but it feels like a very awful judgment to indulge in such pursuits when you know what kind of castle you are in. Alright, and we do know, of course, a plethora of unrested dead to choose from you, what you know right now. And the number is only gonna increase as we move forward. You know what? Now let's go back to 1489, where John O'Carroll, the one who died of the plague at the Leap. So it's said that large dungeons were situated below the keep, and there were many bricked up passages and secret chambers. One of the former people is said to lead a neighbor's wrath. A guardroom on the east side was hewn out of rock. Of numerous bones has been found in different parts of the building. The presence of dungeons is really a good sign, I mean, and add a little bit of plague in it, then a little bit of a Gothic woman who practices occult. And no wonder Leap Castle in itself is like Ireland's most populated this ghostly place, and a quote, owing more spooks to the room than all others together. Now, during the parliamentary wars, Mr. Darby of Leap epused, as the fancy British people say, or to the normal people. He was married to the king's cause. The tradition was that Cornwall appeared before the castle, saying that if they did not surrender in the 24 hours, that he would blow them out with a plum stick. Now, the fortress was not tenable in the event, even if a cannon was fired at it, but as it was commanded from many sides. Now, the weird story of Jonathan Derby III of that time, also known as the Wild Captain, which I told you about, he basically like did his thing with the money and hid it in the treasure, and like hid the treasure in the walls. And when one of the messengers came back, he slew or like killed the messengers and the people who helped him hide the money, and said a secret is only safe with three when the two are dead. Later he was arrested on a charge of high treason, and he was imprisoned in Birr. He was several times reprieved and at last liberated, his legs having modified. Upon his return, he was only capable of murmuring, my money," but it was quite unable to say where it was concealed. In the 19th century, investigators of psychical phenomena reported a litany of ghosts going up and down, most likely tied to various blood-curdling episodes of the history of castle, or maybe Jonathan himself like pacing up and down as a dead man trying to find his money which he has forgotten about. Now, this is it. This is the most fun part of the entire story. Now, there's a thing called the oubliette in the castle. When it was renovated in the 1900s, the workers found a oubliette, which is basically a dungeon which is only accessible by an overhead hatch. Now, this thing, it kind of looks like a small a washroom, a small washroom bathroom slash door, but instead of a floor underneath, there's a vacant hole which is it's a gaping hole, okay, and it was behind the walls of the chapel. And it was filled with 3 cartloads of human bones who had been dropped 8 feet into the pit and had been impaled on wooden spikes, placed there which were placed specifically for the purpose. This is, of course, not the only, like, this is one of the most gruesome ways to die, but which would lead to a resentful death, creating unwanted energy. And it's actually said in the historical documents that this was their way of disposing unwanted guests and unruly peasants. I mean, imagine the immense amount of power you have. You are like walking out and you see like these idiots and you're like, all right, let's pick them up and let's throw them in this little pit where they're gonna die. I'm gonna kill all the children or in my neighborhood. So, yeah, now it's related to this oubliette that a ghostly red lady has been associated with the castle, which has 2 other female children, one of which was said to have died falling into the castle basements, and some sort of grey elemental crittle. I even saw a YouTube video on this, a woman who entered there. She saw red lights flashing and some kind of snaring or sighs. I do not remember exactly. Now, the word elemental, which was so popularized in my story as well. So the elemental is basically understood as an evolved ghost. It's an evolved archetype force. And the specific elemental in the I'm gonna give you this little bit in just a sec. Now, the first theory of the elemental which is in the castle, basically elementals are beings who are associated with the elements, but in this case is basically a very strong spirit. Let's go with that. It's a very strong energy. Now, the first theory is that it was placed there by the druids to protect the sacred site for initiation and magic. This is something which I did not tell you, that the grounds where the castle is built was originally a Celtic druid land, not the Victorian druids, the proper actual druid land. So that can be reasoned why there was so many curses and like people dying here. The second theory is that Earl Gerald Fitzgerald, who was the uncrowned king of Uncrowned High King of Ireland, put the elemental there to kill the O'Carrolls. the third theory that when Mildred Darby was in the house, she dabbled into the dark arts and ended up provoking the elemental and leading to its awakening. And the fourth one is that, and this theory was coined recently, that it was the discovery of the oubliette, which created the release of enormous amount of energy, manifesting the elemental, and it also helps the elemental has holes in his skin. So there's that. An account of the, you know, interaction with the elemental was already told in the story. Now this is another one from an investigation which was held in the castle. It's from the 18th June 2002. And it reads, "I traveled to the Leap Castle in order to make a show for the local TV. This was my first time in the notorious castle I had heard so much about. So the show went well, but I went to try the UV cam recorder while still shooting. I sensed something down the old access to the battlements earlier I had never felt. I climbed the stairs with the camcorder on. The light from the UV allowed me to see 6 feet ahead and no more. So I climbed rather slowly. I opened the Gothic style door and made my way slowly into the narrow passage. About 10 feet in, I saw something move and I lifted my head. I could feel something was wrong, but I had no idea what. This time, with the camera dropped, I thought I saw a glow come from around the corner, and then it went back in. I stood and studied this for a while, though it may be a side effect of the UV, which was common. The few steps more and my body was weakening fast. It was a strange sensation. Suddenly, the mass of white mist raced around the corner like a bull. Even the rubbish on the floor scattered as it approached at speed. The passage was tight. I turned to my left and tried to get out, but it was all the way through back. This startled me a little and we proceeded to arrange shooting in the cellars. The audio refused to tape again in the cellars and I felt really odd. I was sweating heavily before becoming very weak and felt as if I was getting drowned in it. Right after the incident in the tunnel, it felt as if a hole in my chest had been punctured on a spiritual level and my life was seeping into the stones. In order to describe it, I let the reader understand what would have been an experience of large blood loss sometime in their life. As they felt the blood drain, their weakness became more prominent. In other words, I was experiencing the onset of death. I was dying." Yeah, that was it. Imagine being this person. You are like harmlessly shooting for your TV and then suddenly you feel like you are dying. You feel the pain of the ghost which once person human that died there. So yeah, there was another encounter with an elemental who was like, and the person goes on to talk about the Leap Castle, how it looks like a set from the Vincent Price movie. Now these guys, like this specific review, it's from the Dublin Ghostbusters, and they were like, you know, kind of skeptic about everything. So they were very fairly confident about everything, like my protagonist was. But they, as soon as they entered the castle, they started to speak in whispers and they, and I quote, "spun like a ballerina to see the cause of the slightest sound. Now they say that when they heard a sound, they like, he just spun back like a ballerina, and the flashlight hit a rock and it went out. Above him, he could see the jagged outline of the floor. He could hear his friends coming to help him, and then in the darkness he could hear like a snorting sound, like, you know how the pigs make, oh my god, what I'm doing in this podcast, yeah, that sound. And there was a horrid rotten smell, he says. He and that night he just felt this and he shot upwards, scrabbling madly. He made past the doorway and did not stop running until he was safely in the car. And Yeah, then there was. Hey, I just realized most of the encounters which have been written happened in June. And like this another one, which was on the spiral stairway, when the person smelled sulfur. Moreover, it said that the elemental has the potential to cause great harm to anybody. And you know, if somebody ends up receiving an attack head on, one belief also says that the elemental has an ability to alter the atmospheric pressure by generally lowering it, and the polarity of the atmospheric ion fluctuates with it, and it triggers a condition known as a serotonin hyperfunction syndrome. This is something which causes heart some like you know your that thing, I forgot the word, nausea, vomiting, sweats, chills, tremors, dizziness, fatigue. And you could feel that your skin and hair have developed an electrical charge. That's how strong the energy is in the house. Now, the theory has been generated over the last 10 years that this is like a theory which has generated over the last 10 years, but the symptoms are very close and similar to what how Mildred Darby described in the early 1900s. She said, and I quote, "I felt every hair on my head separate and move, for my flesh all over my body, and my scalp crept. Every hair on my head stood straight on the end. The absolute weakness that came over me, the seeming cessation of pulses of life, the grip in the heart and the brain, the deadly numbness which rendered me incapable of thought, word, or action when I first saw the awful beast." Now, when I like a lot of haunted part of this of the entire castle come from Mildred, because duh, well, she lived there, but everybody that I was able to read who goes there. Now, a lot of people haven't seen the ghost or documented it, but it's like the energy there is. You can basically cut bricks from the air. That's how thick, that's how, you know, rancid the atmosphere is, according to a lot of people. Now, even the haunted chapel where all these people were killed, Mildred recounts a story when one day she woke up and she felt a stone cold hand grabbing hers. Whatever it was, she like went down to like pray and stuff. And she also wrote how there was a blood stain on the floor of the haunted chapel, which cannot be washed away. But I was not able to find any other claim saying that there's a blood stain there. Now, the priest house itself is considered to be haunted, as it was, and it's never been refurbished ever since. It's just an empty shell of what it was. But it's said that in the day, Darby's heavy shadow base hung on the place. A peasant man pushing a barrel up the stairs is seen. A monk of an unknown past is often seen on the windows before leaving one through the other. Sometimes if somebody's sleeping there, they would feel a very, very heavy weight on them, a weight that is said to have been snoring. Now imagine you're sleeping and a ghost decides to lay on you, and a heavy ghost at that. And I also read this thing that there are some they see like children waving, then there are screams rattling, doors opening, and you know, all that normal things that happened. Now in the present, the Ryans, the present the castle is with the Ryans, and it was rebuilt in 1822 once it not 1922 when it was burned down. It was rebuilt by Peter Bartlett, who is an Australian historian builder, and also happened to be a distant relative of the O'Bannon clan who originally built the castle. You know, it's like a full circle. The castle was passed to Sheen Ryan, a musician, in 1991, and 3 years after the death of the restorer. Now, Sheen Ryan, he lives there with his wife and children. I do not know how people decide to buy such a home for, like, it's a castle, okay, and it's gothic. I can't, okay, I wanna buy it too now. And like a lot of people, just by the listening to the history of it, they're like, no, not me, but Sean, fuck, it's Sean Ryan, not Sean Ryan. What the fuck is wrong with you? I'm really sorry. So Sean, And Sean lives there happily, you know. One would imagine there to be glum and stuff, but the logs crackle in the large heat on the lift. The walls and the tables have a collection of memorabilia. The family screams of life and not death. Nobody's killing anybody at the moment. And yeah, he has been doing this for the last 25 years and has been living happily ever after in the castle. People still do come there to have ghost tours and stuff. Maybe he earns money out of that too. But yeah, that's it for this haunted as fuck castle and its amazing glorific history. And this was not very long one. This was not a very long one. I did not know that I would be able to cover it. I was expecting it to take at least 2 hours, but yay. Though, thank you so freaking much, Jordan, for the research and for giving me the skeleton of the story and basically making the entire episode possible. The podcast is hosted by Koi On Air. It's co-produced with Nifix. The music is by Lil Addy. And you can reach out to me on Twitter and Instagram. My handle is @KoiOnAir. My email address is koi@madebynifix.com. And I just realized we are supposed to release the listeners validation episode soon too. So there's that. Oh my god, there's so much work. Yeah, I love you guys. I love you so much. And okay, bye-bye. I love you.